What was a Jedi doing on Dune?
A member of the Council contacted me and asked that I allow one of their people to make contact with the rebels, the king informed her. I agreed to their request. The princess blinked in surprise. Still standing rigidly at attention, Lucia gave no outward reaction, though she was just as stunned as her mistress.
We've always tried to keep the Jedi and the Senate out of our business on Dune, Sarah protested.
The politics of our world are under attack, the king explained. Support for the rebels is building within the galactic community. We need allies if we want to preserve the Dune way of life. Working with the Jedi will make them and the Senate less willing to take action against us.
What did he come here for? Sarah demanded, her voice cold. The king scowled. Lucia realized he didn't like being interrogated in his own throne room. But possibly out of respect for his lost son, he didn't take the princess to task.
The Jedi had news that the rebels may have uncovered a cache of ancient talismans, objects imbued with the power of the dark side. The Saurian was sent to investigate these claims and, if true, bring the talismans back to the Jedi Temple on Coruscant, where they could do no harm.
Lucia could see the logic behind the king's decision to grant the Jedi leave for their mission on Dune. The last thing the nobility wanted was for their enemies to gain possession of potentially devastating weapons. If the reports were true, the best way to nullify the threat would be to have the Jedi deal with it. Unfortunately, the death of the Saurian was not part of the plan.
You think the Jedi will blame you for Med's death?
The princess noted, her sharp mind putting all the pieces together.
You knew he was making contact with the rebels. It will look like you hired the assassin to follow him to their hideout.
The king gave a solemn nod.
Gelba's death has dealt a great blow to our enemy, but others will surely rise to take their place. Terrorists breed like insects, and our war with them is far from over. So far, the Senate has not interfered in our efforts to cleanse our world of these criminals. But if they believe I use the Jedi to further my personal desire for vengeance, they will not sit idly by.
The king rose from his throne, standing up to his full height. He towered over Sarah, where she stood on the steps below the dais.
But this assassin was not acting on my orders, he pronounced in a voice that echoed off the throne room walls. This was done without my knowledge or consent. A clear violation of Dune law that may cost us everything.
Is that why you brought me here, sire? Sarah asked, refusing to be cowed by his anger. To accuse me of betraying you? There was a long silence as they stared at each other before the king spoke again.
When my son first declared his intention to marry you, I opposed the union, he replied.
He was speaking casually now, almost as if they were chatting over a meal. But Lucia could see his eyes were fixed on the princess, studying her intently. Yes, sire, Sarah answered, giving away no hint of emotion. He told me as much.
You have secrets, the king continued. All my efforts to learn about your parents or your family turned up nothing. Your past is well hidden.
My past is of no consequence, sire. Your son accepted that.
I have watched you these past 3 years, the king admitted. I could see that you loved my son. I could see you were devastated by his death.
Sarah didn't say anything, but Lucia could see moist tears beginning to form in her eyes as she thought back on memories of her husband.
Over the years, I have come to appreciate those qualities my son saw in you. Your strength, your intelligence, your loyalty to our house. But now my son is dead, and I cannot help but wonder where your true loyalties lie.
I swore an oath to serve the crown when I married Garen, Sarah told him, her voice firm, despite the tears in her eyes. Even though he's gone, I would not dishonor his memory by abandoning my duties.
I believe you,
the king said after several seconds, his voice suddenly weary.
Though this brings me no closer to finding out who was behind the attack.
Silently, Lucia let out the breath she hadn't been aware she was holding. The king sat back down on his throne, his expression troubled by doubt and lingering grief over his son. Sarah stepped forward and knelt by her father-in-law, close enough to put a comforting hand on his arm, ignoring his guards as they took a menacing step forward. "Your son was beloved by all the nobles of Doan," she said, "and the rebels are universally despised. Anyone could have hired the assassin, with no knowledge whatsoever that the Jedi would be there. The Saurian's death was an unfortunate accident, not some sinister plot."
"I fear the Jedi may not be so easily convinced," the king replied.
"Then let me speak to them," Sarah offered. "Send me to Coruscant. I will make them understand that you had no part in this."
"I have seen you in the halls these past months," the king told her. "I know the pain you still carry over my son's loss. I cannot ask you to do this while you are still mourning his death."
"That is why I must be the one to go," Sarah countered. "The Jedi will be more willing to show compassion to a grieving widow. Let me do this for you, sire. It's what Garen would have wanted."
The king considered her offer briefly before nodding. Sarah rose and took her leave with a bow. Lucia fell into step behind her as she left the throne room, only pausing at the doors long enough to collect her weapons. Only when they were back in the privacy of the princess's chamber, with the door closed carefully behind them, did either of them dare to speak.
"Take this somewhere and burn it," Sarah spat as she ripped the mourning veil from her head and cast it down to the floor. "I never want to see it again."
"I have something to confess,"
Lucia said as she scooped the discarded garment up from the floor. Sarah turned to look at her, but Lucia couldn't read the expression on her face.
"I'm the one who hired the assassin that killed Gelba," she said, speaking quickly to get the words out. She wanted to say so much more.
She wanted to explain that she had known nothing about the Jedi being on Doan. She needed Sarah to understand that she had done it only for her sake.
Lucia had always sensed a darkness in the healer, a shadow on her spirit. With Garen's death, that shadow had grown. She had seen her friend slipping into bleak despair as the weeks turned to months, listlessly wandering the halls of the castle in her black mourning garb like some tormented ghost. All she wanted was to try to ease the princess's suffering. She thought that maybe if those responsible for Garen's death were made to pay, Sarah could find closure, could move on and come out from the shadow that had fallen over her. She wanted to say all this, but she couldn't. She was just a soldier. She wasn't any good with words.
Sarah stepped forward and wrapped her arms around her in a long, gentle hug. "When the king spoke of someone hiring an assassin to avenge Garen's death, I thought it might be you," she whispered. "Thank you."
And Lucia knew she didn't have to tell the princess all the things she wanted to say. Her friend already knew.
"I think you should tell the king," Lucia said when the princess finally broke off her embrace.
"He'd have you arrested," Sarah said with a firm shake of her head. "Or at the very least, dismissed from your post. I can't have that. I need you at my side when I go to Coruscant."
"You still plan to speak with the Jedi?"
she asked, mildly surprised.
"What are you going to tell them?"
"Med's death was an accident. The king was not involved. That's all they need to know."
Lucia had her doubts, but she knew the princess well enough to realize that arguing the point would be a waste of time. Sarah had no intention of turning her in to either the king or the Jedi. But she couldn't just let it go at that.
"I never meant to cause any trouble for you, or the king. I'm sorry."
"Don't ever apologize for this,"
Sarah shot back. "Gelba and her followers got exactly what they deserved. My only regret is that I wasn't there to see it myself."
The venom in her words, the raw anger and hatred, caught Lucia off guard.
Instinctively, she took a step back, recoiling from her friend. But then Sarah smiled, and the awkward moment was gone.
"We need to leave as soon as possible," the princess noted. "It won't do to keep the council waiting."
"I'll make the arrangements,"
Lucia replied, though she knew it would be several days before their actual departure. As the princess, it wasn't easy for Sarah to simply leave Doan. There were diplomatic protocols and bureaucratic procedures that had to be followed.
"This will all work out,"
Sarah reassured her, coming over to place a comforting hand on Lucia's arm.
"Gelba is dead,"
My husband is avenged. A quick meeting with one of the Jedi Masters, and this whole incident will be behind us.
Lucia nodded, but she knew it wouldn't be that simple. This wasn't just going to go away. The death of the Jedi had set in motion a chain of events, one she feared might end very badly for both of them.
Chapter 3. The cantina was almost empty at this time of day. The crowds wouldn't start arriving until the late evening, which was exactly why Darth Bane had arranged this meeting for early afternoon. His contact, a balding, slightly overweight man of about 50 named Argal Ten, was already there, seated at a private booth in the back of the establishment. Nobody paid any special attention to the Dark Lord as he crossed the room. Everyone here, including Argal, knew him only as Sep Omek, one of the many wealthy merchants who lived on Sutrik. Bane sat down in the seat across the table from the other man and summoned a waitress with a discreet wave of his hand. She came over and took their order, then slipped away to leave them to their business. On Sutrik, it was common for merchants to make deals in the backs of bars and clubs, and the serving staff knew how to respect the confidentiality of their customers.
How come we never meet at your estate?
Argal said by way of greeting.
I hear you have one of the best-stocked wine cellars on the planet.
I'd rather not have my sister learn about our transactions,
Bane replied. Argal chuckled slightly.
I understand completely.
He stopped speaking while the waitress returned and set their drinks on the table, then continued in a quieter voice when she was gone.
Many of my clients are reluctant to let friends and family know of their interest in the dark side.
Dealing with Argal always left a sour taste in Bane's mouth, but for this, there was no one else he could turn to. The portly dealer was the sector's leading procurer of banned Sith manuscripts. He had built a small fortune by discreetly seeking them out, purchasing them, and delivering them in person to his clients, while keeping their names from ever being linked to the transaction. Of course, most of his clients were nothing but collectors or Sith fetishists, who simply longed to possess a work that had been officially banned by the Jedi Council. They had no real understanding of the dark side or its power. They bought and sold the manuscripts in blissful ignorance, unaware of what they were truly dealing with. This, more than anything, was what brought the bile to Bane's throat each time he met with Argal. The man portrayed himself as an expert in the dark side. He bartered and traded the secrets of the ancient Sith like cheap rugs at an open-air bazaar. It galled Bane to think of what treasures had passed through his hands into the possession of those too weak and common to ever make use of them. He had occasionally fantasized about revealing his true identity to Argal, just to see his terrified reaction. Bane wanted to watch him grovel, begging for mercy at the feet of a real Sith. But petty revenge against an insignificant speck of a man was beneath him. Argal was useful, and so Bane would continue to play the part of a Sith-obsessed merchant.
I hope you were able to find what I was looking for, he muttered. The details you provided were rather vague.
I promise you this, Sep, the other man replied with a cunning smile. You will not be disappointed. But you have no idea how hard this was,
Argal added, throwing in an exaggerated sigh.
What you're after is illegal, banned by the Jedi Council.
Everything you deal in is banned by the Jedi Council.
This was different. I'd never even heard the name Darth and Dedu before. None of my suppliers had. I had to go outside the normal channels. But I came through, like I always do in the end.
Bane scowled.
I trust you were careful. I wouldn't want word of this to make its way back to the Jedi.
Argal laughed.
Oh, what's the matter, Sep? Some of your business practices not quite on the up and up? Afraid the Council will come after you for cheating on your taxes?
Something like that?
Don't worry. Nobody will ever know you were involved. I only brought it up because I may have to renegotiate our original price.
We had a deal.
Now, you know my initial quote is only an estimate, Orgel reminded him. I had to outlay triple my normal expenses to track this particular item down. But I'm willing to give you a bargain and only charge you double my original offer.
Bane gritted his teeth, knowing his hopes of a quick end to their conversation would remain unfulfilled. He had the funds to simply pay, of course, but this would arouse suspicion. He had a role to play, that of a savvy merchant. If he didn't negotiate down to the last credit, it would seem strange. I'll give you a 10% bonus, nothing more. For the next 20 minutes, they haggled back and forth, finally settling on 40% above the starting price.
A pleasure doing business with you, as always,
Argyll said once payment was agreed upon. From inside his vest, he produced a long, thin tube, roughly 30 centimeters long. The tube was sealed at one end, and the other was capped with a tightly screwed-on lid.
If the item proves unsatisfactory, he noted as he handed it over, I will be happy to take it back and return your funds. Less a reasonable commission, of course.
I highly doubt that will be necessary,
Bane replied as he wrapped his fingers tightly around the tube. With the transaction complete, there was no point in staying at the cantina. Bane was eager to open his prize, but he resisted until he was safely back inside the privacy of the library annex on his personal estate. There, beneath the pale glow of the lonely overhead light, he carefully unscrewed the lid. He tipped the tube, allowing the single sheaf of paper rolled up inside to slide out. His instructions to Argyll had been simple. Be on the lookout for any book, volume, tome, manuscript, or scroll that made mention of a Sith Lord named Darth Andedu. He couldn't say anything more than that for fear of raising suspicions or awkward questions, but he had hoped it would be enough. For 2 months, his supplier had turned up nothing. But then, just as Bane was beginning to fear the Jedi had successfully buried all trace of Andedu and his secrets, Argyll had delivered. The scroll was yellow with age, and Bane gingerly unfurled the dry, cracked page. As he did so, he marveled at the long and untraceable chain of events that had allowed the scroll to not only survive across the millennia, but eventually make its way into his hands. He had chosen to seek the scroll out, yet on some level, he felt his choice had been preordained. The scroll was part of the Sith legacy, a legacy that by all rights now belonged to Bane. It was almost as if he had been destined to find it. It was as inevitable as the dark side's eventual triumph over the light. The page had been fashioned from the cured skin of an animal he couldn't identify. On one side, it was rough and covered with dark splotches. The other side had been bleached and scraped smooth before being covered with handwritten lines in a language Bane immediately recognized. The letters were sharp and angular, aggressive and fierce in their design. The alphabet of the original Sith, a long extinct species that ruled Korriban nearly 100,000 years ago. That didn't mean the document was that old, of course. It only meant that whoever wrote it had revered and respected the Sith culture enough to adapt their language as their own. Bane began to read the words, struggling with the archaic tongue. As Argyll had promised, he was not disappointed with the contents. The scroll was a religious proclamation declaring Darth Andedu the immortal and eternal king over the entire world of Prakith. To commemorate the momentous event, the proclamation continued, a great temple would be built in his honor. Satisfied, Bane carefully rolled the scroll up and slid it back into the protective tube. Despite being only a few paragraphs scrolled across a single sheet of parchment, it had given him what he needed. Andedu's followers had built a temple in his honor on the deep core world of Prakith. There was no doubt in Bane's mind that this was where he would find the Dark Lord's holocron. Unfortunately, he had to think of a way to acquire it that wouldn't raise Xana's suspicions. Andedu's holocron offered the promise of immortality. With it, he could live long enough to find and train a new successor. It was unlikely his current apprentice would know the significance of the holocron, but he wasn't willing to take that chance. Though she was loath to challenge him directly, if she learned that he planned to replace her, Bane had no doubt she would do everything in her power to stop him. He couldn't allow the fear of being replaced to become the catalyst that compelled Xana to finally challenge him. Fighting back simply because she knew she was about to be cast aside was nothing but a common survival instinct. His successors would need to do more than just survive if the Sith were ever to grow powerful enough to destroy the Jedi. Xana's challenge had to come from her own initiative, not as a reaction to something he did. Otherwise, it was worthless. This was the complex paradox of the master-apprentice relationship, and it had put Bane into an untenable position. He couldn't send Xana after the holocron, and if he went after it himself, she would almost certainly suspect something. He rarely traveled off-world anymore. Any journey would immediately put her on her guard. She might try to follow him, or prepare some type of trap to be sprung on his return. Even though she had disappointed Bane by not challenging him, Xana was still a dangerous and formidable opponent. It was possible she might defeat him, leaving the Sith with a leader who lacked the necessary drive and ambition. Her complacency would infect the Order. Eventually, it would wither and die. He couldn't allow that to happen, which meant he had to find something to occupy Xana's attention while he made the long and arduous journey into the Deep Core. Fortunately, he had already had something in mind. Bane's personal study, unlike the secluded private library tucked in the back corner of the estate, was a buzzing hive of endless electronic activity. Even when unoccupied, the room was illuminated by the flickering images of HoloNet newsfeeds, the glow of data screens showing stock tickers from a dozen different planetary exchanges, or blinking readouts on the monitors indicating private communications filtering in from the network of informants he and Xana had assembled over the years. For all the opulence and extravagance throughout the mansion, more credits had been spent on this room than any other. With all the terminals, holo projectors, and screens, it looked more like the communications hub of a busy starport than a den in a private residence. Yet the study was no grandiose display of wealth. Rather, it was a testament to efficiency and practicality. Every single piece of equipment had been carefully chosen to handle the staggering volume of data passing through the room. Thousands of data units every hour, all recorded and stored for later review and analysis. The study helped reinforce the illusion that he and Xana were wealthy entrepreneurs, obsessively scouring news from the farthest reaches of the galaxy in search of profitable business ventures. To some degree, this was even true. Every credit spent on the study was an investment that would eventually pay off 100-fold. Over the past decade, Bane had used the information he had gathered to grow his wealth significantly. Though for the Dark Lord, material riches were only a means to an end. He understood that power came from knowledge, and his vast fortune had allowed him to assemble the priceless collection of ancient Sith teachings he kept secured in his private library. Yet he was interested in more than just the forgotten secrets of the dark side. From the halls of the Republic Senate to the tribal councils of the most backrocket planets on the Outer Rim, the lifeblood of government was information. History was shaped by individuals who understood that information, properly exploited and controlled, could defeat any army. Bane had seen proof of this firsthand. The Brotherhood of Darkness was destroyed not by the Jedi and their army of light, but by the carefully laid plans of a single man. Ancient scrolls and manuscripts could unlock the secrets of the dark side, but to bring down the Jedi and the Republic, Bane first had to know everything about his enemies. The network of agents and go-betweens he had assembled over the years were a key part of his plan, but they weren't enough. Individuals were fallible. Their reports were biased or incomplete. Whenever possible, Bane preferred to rely on pure data, plucked from the web of information that wove itself through every planet of the Republic.
He needed to be aware of every detail of every plan put forth by the Senate and the Jedi Council. If he ever hoped to shape and manipulate galactic events to bring about the downfall of the Republic, he had to know what they were doing now and anticipate what they would do next. The complexity of his machinations required constant attention. He had to react to unexpected changes as they happened, altering his long-term plans to keep them on course. More important, he needed to seize upon unexpected opportunities as they arose, using them to their fullest advantage, like the situation on Doan. Bane had never paid the small mining world on the Outer Rim much attention before. That had changed 3 days ago, when he noticed an expense claim submitted to the Senate for approval by a representative acting on behalf of the Doan royal family. It wasn't unusual for Bane to be reviewing Senate budget reports. By law, all financial documentation filed through official Republic channels was available for public viewing. For a price, of course. The cost was high, and typically, all it resulted in was an onerous list of customs regulations, taxes levied in accordance with economic treaties, or funding appeals for various projects and special interest groups. Occasionally, however, something of true significance would filter through the clutter. In this case, it was a line-item request for the reimbursement of costs incurred by the Doan royal family to transport the body of a Saurian Jedi named Med Tandar back to Coruscant. There were no further details. Budget reports were rarely interested in the why. Bane, however, was very interested. What was a Jedi Knight doing on Doan? More importantly, how had he died? Ever since first seeing the report, Bane had been mining his sources to try to find the answers. He had to tread carefully where the Jedi were concerned. For the Sith to survive, they had to remain hidden in the shadows. But through a long chain of bureaucrats, household servants, and paid informants, he had assembled enough facts to realize the situation was worthy of more thorough investigation. And so, he had sent for Xana. Seated behind the desk at the center of the screens and holoprojectors, he could hear her coming down the hall, the hard heels of her boots clacking against the floor with each stride. Resting on the left side of the desk was a data disk containing all the information he had compiled on Med Tandar and his visit to Doan. He reached out for it without thinking and froze. For a brief instant, his hand hovered in the air, trembling involuntarily. Then he quickly snatched it back, hiding it beneath the edge of the desk just as Xana entered the room. "You sent for me, Lord Bane." She made no acknowledgement of the tremor, yet Bane was certain it had not gone unnoticed. Was she playing him for a fool, pretending not to see his weakness in the hope he would become careless and let his guard down? Or was she silently gloating while she bided her time, waiting for the dark side to simply rot his body away? Xana was only 10 years younger than Bane, but if the dark side was extracting a similar physical toll on her, it had yet to show itself. Unlike her master, she had never been infested with the Orbalisks. It would still be many decades before the corruption of the dark side caused her body to wither. Her curly golden hair was still long and lustrous, her skin still smooth and perfect. Of average height, she had the figure of a gymnast, lean, lithe, and strong. She wore fitted black pants and a sleeveless red vest embroidered with silver, an outfit that was both stylish, by current Siutric standards, and practical, in that it would not hinder movement. The handle of her twin-bladed lightsaber hung from her hip. Over the past few years, she had never come into her master's presence without it. The hooked handle of Bane's own weapon was clipped to the belt of his breeches. It would have been foolish to leave himself unarmed and vulnerable before the apprentice who had sworn to one day kill him. "I'm still waiting for that day," Bane thought. Out loud, he said, "I need you to make a trip to the Outer Rim, a planet called Doan, where a Jedi was murdered 3 standard days ago. Anyone powerful enough to kill a Jedi is worthy of our attention," Xana admitted. "Do we know who's responsible?" "That is what you need to find out." Xana nodded, her eyes narrowing as she processed the information. What was a Jedi doing on an insignificant planet in the Outer Rim? "That is something else you need to find out,"
The Jedi will send one of their own to investigate. She noted.
Not right away, Bane assured her. The Dawn royal family is calling in political favors to delay the investigation. They've sent a representative to meet with the Jedi Council on Coruscant instead.
The royal family must be rich. Those kinds of favors don't come cheap. Small world, but not widely known, yet with wealthy royals. Valuable resources? Mining? She guessed. Xana had always been able to grasp bits of information and put them together into something meaningful. She would have been a worthy successor. If only she had possessed the ambition to seize the Sith throne.
The planet's been carved down nearly to the core. There are only a few habitable kilometers of land left on the surface. All food has to be shipped in. Most of the population live and work in the strip mines.
Sounds charming, she muttered, before adding, I'll leave tonight. Bane nodded, dismissing her. Only after she was gone did he dare to place his still quivering hand back on top of the desk. The death of a Jedi was always of interest to him, but in truth, he cared about finding Undedu's holocron far more than he did about the outcome of Xana's mission. Fortunately, the incident on Doan offered the perfect distraction. Investigating the Outer Rim world would keep his apprentice occupied while he braved the dangerous hyperspace routes into the core to retrieve the holocron. If things went as he hoped, he would be back long before she returned to give him her report, with Xana none the wiser. Confident in his plan, Bane focused all his concentration on calming the tremor that still gripped his hand. But for all his power, for all his mental discipline, the muscles continued to twitch involuntarily. In frustration, he balled up his fist and slammed it once hard upon the surface of the desk, leaving a faint impression in the soft wood. Chapter 4. Seutric IV's twin moon shone brightly down on Xana's airspeeder as it zipped through the night sky. The evening's rain clouds were just beginning to build. They were still no more than wispy veils that simply tore apart as her vehicle ripped through them. On the ground below, still a few kilometers ahead, she could see the lights of Diplona's primary spaceport. A light on the nav panel blinked a warning, indicating she was approaching the 2-kilometer limit of restricted airspace that surrounded the port. Her hands moving with casual precision over the controls, she brought the speeder in for a landing at the section reserved for those wealthy enough to afford private hangars for their personal shuttles. As the vehicle gently touched down on the pad located on the starport's perimeter, three men scurried out to meet her. The first, a valet, tended to her speeder, whisking it away toward the secure lot where it would be parked until she returned. The second man, a porter, loaded her luggage onto a small hover sled, then waited patiently as the third man approached.
Good evening, Mr. Somek, he greeted her.
From their first arrival on Seutric, Xana and Bane had worked hard to build up their identities as Alia and Sep Omek. After nearly a decade, she was able to slip into the role of the wealthy import-export trader without even thinking about it. Chet? She said, with a nod to the customs official as the young man handed her an official-looking form. For the common masses, arrivals and departures at the Diplona spaceport were a long and arduous process. Because the world was built on commerce and trade, the government required copies of trip itineraries, verification of ship registration, and a host of forms and permits to be filled out before the port authority would clear a vessel, its contents, or its passengers. This frequently involved a thorough inspection of the ship's interior by customs personnel, with the official explanation being increased planetary security. However, everyone knew inspections were actually meant to discourage merchants from trying to transport undeclared merchandise in the hope of avoiding interstellar taxes and tariffs. Fortunately, Xana didn't have to worry about any of that. She simply signed the departure form and handed it back to Chet. One of the chief benefits of maintaining a private hangar at the port was the ability to come and go at will. In exchange for their substantial monthly hangar fees, the government kept its nose out of her and Bane's business. A bargain at nearly any price, as far as she was concerned.
You'll be taking your private shuttle, I assume?
That's right, she replied, the Victory over in Hangar 13.
I'll alert the control tower.
Chet gave a curt nod to the porter, who headed off with the hover sled in the direction of the hangar.
Just a moment, the customs official said softly to Xana, causing her to hang back.
Heard some news I thought you might be interested in,
he continued, once the porter had disappeared around the corner.
Argle 10 touched down a few days ago to meet with your brother.
Xana had never met Argle, but she knew who he was and what he did. Over the past few years, she had slowly been gathering information on all the members in Darth Bane's network of contacts. They could prove useful to her once she took over the Sith. She didn't know if Argle's arrival was relevant or not. Bane was always looking to acquire rare Sith manuscripts, and it could just be a coincidence. Nevertheless, she filed the knowledge away in case it should ever prove handy.
Thanks for the update,
she said, slipping Chet a 50-credit chip before heading off toward her private hangar. The porter was already there, waiting with her bags by the shuttle. Xana punched in the security code, causing the boarding ramp to lower.
Put everything in the back,
she instructed, smiling and handing the porter a 10-credit chip.
Right away, mistress,
he replied, the tip disappearing instantly into a pocket somewhere in his uniform as he hustled to load her baggage. Xana kept the smile plastered on her face while he worked. She made a point of being friendly with everyone at the spaceport. She saw it as an investment in the future, the cultivation of a potential resource. The members of the Senate and other powerful individuals might shape galactic policy, but it was the bureaucrats, government officials, and various other low-level political functionaries who actually made things run. And they were so much easier to deal with than the political elite. A few kind words and a handful of small bribes, and Xana could get anything she needed without attracting unwanted attention, just as she had done with Chet. This was one advantage she had over Bane. She knew she was attractive. Men, in particular, were drawn to her because of her looks. They wanted to help her, to please her. Xana wasn't above encouraging them with a soft laugh or a subtle touch. It was a small price to pay to establish a relationship that might eventually prove useful. Her master's appearance, on the other hand, would never inspire anything but fear in those who didn't know him. Only once the porter was gone and she was alone in the cockpit of the vessel did she let the facade drop. Settling into the custom-molded seat, she punched in the navigation coordinates. Through the cockpit viewport, she could see the Triumph, Bane's personal shuttle, in the adjacent hangar. Like her own, it was a Cygnus Spaceworks Theta-class T-1 vessel, the latest and most expensive personal interplanetary transport shuttle available on the open market. Everything about their life here in Ceutric, the mansion, their clothes, even their social calendar, was a part of their disguise. They surrounded themselves with luxury and material comforts, a far cry from the austere life they had led during their years on Ambria. There were times when Xana missed the simplicity of those early days. Life on Ambria had been hard, but it had kept her strong, and she couldn't help but wonder if the lavish lifestyle here on Ceutric had made her and Bane soft. The Victory's engines roared to life, and the shuttle rose up a few meters off the ground. Xana piloted by instinct, while her mind continued its train of thought. Life was a constant struggle. The strong would survive and the weak would perish. That was the way of the universe. The natural order. It was the philosophy embraced by the code of the Sith. But here on Ceutric, it was easy to be lulled into a sense of peace. Peace is a lie. There is only passion. Through passion, I gain strength. Through strength, I gain power. Through power, I gain victory. Through victory, my chains are broken. Xana understood that chains were not always made of iron and durasteel. They could sometimes be woven of expensive shimmer silk. The easy life they enjoyed on Ceutric was a trap, as dangerous as any the Jedi could ever set for them. She had continued her study and training even after Bane had moved them into their magnificent estate outside the city. But the sense of urgency and the threat of danger that had spurred her on during her early years had faded, replaced by the ennui of security and contentment. It was time to stake her claim as Dark Lord of the Sith. She would already have challenged him by now if not for two things. The first was the tremor she had noticed in his left hand several months ago. He tried to hide it from her, but she noticed it more and more. She didn't know the cause of the tremor, but regardless, it was an obvious sign of his degenerating skills. Perhaps too obvious. Bane was a master manipulator. Xana couldn't dismiss the idea that he was faking it. What if the tremor was a ruse meant to lure her into the confrontation before she was truly ready? One final test to see if the apprentice had learned the lesson of patience he had worked so hard to ingrain into her. I will strike at a time of my choosing, Xana vowed to herself. Not his. But in order to make her move, she had to be ready with an apprentice of her own. Two there should be, no more, no less. One to embody the power, the other to crave it. The rule of two was inviolate. If she was going to seize the mantle of master from Bane, she would need to find an apprentice. So far, despite her best efforts, she had failed to locate even a single potential candidate. Bane had recognized her own potential when, as a young girl, she had killed the Jedi who had mistakenly slain her friend. Now, she was going to investigate the mysterious death of another Jedi. Might she find her successor the same way Bane had found her? But if she was thinking along these lines, it was a sure bet that Bane had thought of it too. He was rarely caught unprepared or off guard. So, why would Bane send her on a mission that could end with her finding the individual who might become the next Sith apprentice? Did her master want her to challenge him? Was he trying to help her? Or was he looking to replace her? Maybe he had decided she was unworthy of assuming his title. Maybe he was hoping this mission would provide him with someone new to train in the ways of the dark side, and he planned to cast her aside. If that's true, Master, you might be surprised at how this ends. Underestimate me at your peril. A beep from the nav screen notified her as the shuttle broke Ceutrix's atmosphere. A few seconds later, she felt the unmistakable surge as the ship made the leap into hyperspace. Xana eased her seat back and closed her eyes. There was no point in dwelling on all the possibilities of what Bane might or might not be thinking, or what his secret motivations for sending her on the mission might be. The web of his machinations could be too impossibly tangled to unweave. But she knew one thing for sure. Something was about to change. For 20 years, she had served as his loyal apprentice, learning the ways of the Sith. Now her time as a pupil was about to end. Whatever the mission might bring, she had decided this would be the last time she answered to Darth Bane.
Chapter 5.
Coruscant was unlike anything Sarah had ever seen. As a child, she had known nothing but the simple isolation of her father's camp. When he had sent her away, she'd visited dozens of other worlds before settling on Dohne. But all of them had been less populated planets on the Outer Rim. Her entire life had been spent on the fringes of civilization. Here, on the planet-wide metropolis that was the Republic capital, she had been hurled into the madness of the Galactic Core. Kaleeb had made sure his daughter's education was well-rounded. She had read descriptions of Coruscant. She had memorized all the relevant facts and figures. But knowing a world had a population approaching 1 trillion individuals and seeing it in person were entirely different. Sarah simply stared out the window of the airspeeder, speechless, as it darted and dived, fighting its way through the heavy traffic of the skylane. Below, an endless ocean of durasteel and permacrete stretched off to the horizon in all directions, shining with the permanent glow of a million lights. The effect was overwhelming. The crowds, the vehicles, the dull cacophony of sounds that could be heard over the hum of the engines, the sheer magnitude of it was almost more than her mind could grasp. It made her feel small, insignificant. "There it is," Lucia said, nodding out the window. In the distance, Sarah could just make out a massive structure that towered high above the rest of the cityscape. The Jedi Temple. The swift-moving speeder was bringing them rapidly closer, and it wasn't long before she could make out the unique details of the temple's construction. The foundation was a pyramid of successively smaller blocks, creating a stepped or ziggurat effect. On the top of the uppermost level was a tall central spire, surrounded on each corner by smaller secondary spires. Scattered among the spires were open plazas, wide promenades, vast natural gardens, and a number of smaller buildings that served as dorms or administrative centers. As the speeder dropped out of the main line of traffic toward the destination, the structure's true scope became apparent. Everything on Coruscant was grand and magnificent, but the temple dominated the skyline. Sarah recalled that it had been built on top of a mountain. Not on a mountain, like the small settlements the nobles had constructed on the plateaus of Doan, but actually over the mountain. The stepped pyramid covered the entire surface, swallowing the mountain so completely that it was no longer visible. Their vehicle banked in a wide circle around the Tranquility Spire, the tall central tower, before touching down on a landing pad in the shadow of the smaller tower on the northwest corner. "Let's get this over with," Lucia muttered, standing quickly and offering her hand to help Sarah up from her seat. The princess realized Lucia was as uncomfortable as she was, though she suspected her bodyguard's unease had less to do with the overwhelming sights and sounds of Coruscant and more to do with her days as a soldier fighting against the Army of Light. Even after 20 years, Lucia still harbored a resentment toward both the Jedi and the Republic. That and the fact that she still probably felt guilty for hiring the assassin who had killed the Jedi emissary. Sarah, on the other hand, felt nothing but gratitude for what her friend had done. And she had no intention of letting anyone, not the king and not the Jedi, find out that Lucia was responsible. "Remember what I told you," she said, placing a comforting hand on her friend's shoulder. "I have dealt with the Jedi before. I know how to handle them. I know their weaknesses, their blind spots. We will get through this." The bodyguard took a deep breath and nodded. Sarah did the same, centering herself in anticipation of the coming confrontation. Lucia was amazed at how calm and composed the princess appeared as they prepared to leave the shuttle. She had always carried herself with a quiet but firm resolve. It gave her an air of confidence and authority that drew others to her. When she spoke, people gave her words careful consideration, even people like the King of Doan. But this was different. They were about to meet a Jedi Master, and Sarah intended to lie right to his face. Lucia had no intention of letting her friend get into trouble, however. At the first sign the Jedi knew Sarah was being dishonest, she intended to confess everything, no matter the consequences. Steadied by her decision, she was able to maintain her own exterior of composure as they disembarked. Outside the shuttle, they found an escort of three Jedi waiting for them. Two were human, a man and a woman. The third was a female Twi'lek. Each wore plain brown robes with the hood thrown back to reveal their features. Their simple garb, a sharp contrast with Sarah and Lucia's more formal outfits. The princess was wearing a long, flowing, sleeveless dress of blue silk. A finely woven gold stole covered her shoulders and upper arms. Her long black hair hung loose from beneath the elaborate golden tiara she wore, and around her neck was an elegant gold chain and a sapphire pendant, signifying her station within the Doan royal family. Lucia was also dressed in blue and gold, the royal colors, but she wore the dress uniform of the Doan military. Dark blue pants with a gold stripe running up the leg, and a tight light blue shirt covered by a short blue jacket with gold trim buttoned up to the collar. Like the three Jedi, however, her head was bare. The Twi'lek stepped forward with a bow.
"Greetings, Your Highness. My name is Maya. My companions are Pendo and Winua."
Sarah returned the bow with a tilt of her head.
"This is Lucia, my companion,"
she returned. Maya's eyes flicked down to the blaster prominently displayed on Lucia's hip. But all she said was,
"Please follow us. Master Ova is waiting to speak with you."
From the briefings she had reviewed during the trip to Coruscant, Lucia knew that Ova was a member of the Council of First Knowledge. As keepers of ancient Jedi lore, They often provided advice and guidance to the Jedi High Council. He had also been the master of Med Tandar, the Jedi who had died on Dune. The three robed figures led them from the landing pad through a well-tended garden, dotted by a number of memorials and statues. A small crowd of children rushed past them at one point, laughing.
Younglings from the trainee dorms, Maya explained. During afternoons, they are given time away from their studies to play in the gardens.
Sarah didn't reply, but Lucia could see the flicker of sorrow in her eyes. She knew the young couple had been trying to start a family in the weeks before Garen's death. And seeing the children no doubt brought back painful memories. They continued on in silence, the Jedi leading them to the foot of the Northwest Tower and then inside. They climbed up several flights of winding stairs. Toward the end, Lucia noticed that the princess had become short of breath, though neither she nor the Jedi had the same problem. And then, somewhere roughly a quarter of the way up the tower, they stopped outside a large door. Maya knocked, and a deep voice from inside called out,
"Come in."
The Twi'lek opened the door, then stepped to the side with another bow. Sarah entered the room, Lucia following a single step behind. Their escort stayed outside, closing the door. At first glance, the interior of the room might have been mistaken for a greenhouse. A single large window on the far wall allowed sunlight to stream through, making it exceedingly bright and overly warm. Potted plants of at least a dozen different species lined the walls. Another half a dozen grew from boxes along the windowsill, while still more hung from planters affixed to the ceiling. There were no chairs, no table, and no desk. It was only when she noticed a small, straw-woven sleeping mat rolled up in the corner that Lucia realized this was the Jedi Master's personal chambers.
"Welcome, Your Highness. You honor us with your visit."
Master Oba, an Ithorian, was standing with his back to them looking out the window. In the elongated fingers of one hand, he held a watering can. Setting it down on the floor, he turned to face them. Like all Ithorians, he was taller than the average human, easily over 2 meters in height. His rough brown skin looked almost like bark, and his long neck curved down and forward before looping up again, making it seem as if he was leaning toward them. Looking at the eyes bulging out from either side of the top of his tall, flat head made it easy to see why the nickname Hammerhead was often applied to the species. "This is my advisor, Lucia," Sarah told him, sticking with their planned cover story. "Thank you for agreeing to meet with us, Master Oba."
"It was the least I could do, given your circumstances,"
the Ithorian explained, his voice deep and resonant.
"My condolences on your husband. His death was a terrible tragedy."
Lucia was no expert in the subtleties of politics, and she couldn't tell if Oba was simply a compassionate soul expressing real sympathy, or an expert negotiator trying to put the princess emotionally off balance by mentioning Garen.
"My tragedy is mirrored by your own," Sarah replied in the formal tone of a practiced diplomat.
Whatever the Jedi's intentions, his words had no visible effect on her demeanor.
"Allow me to apologize on behalf of the royal family for the unfortunate passing of Med Tandar."
The Ithorian's head dipped in acknowledgement.
"I grieve for his death, and it is of critical importance that we learn the identity of the person or persons responsible."
Lucia felt her heart skip a beat, though she gave no outward sign of her anxiety.
"I understand," Sarah assured him. "The authorities on my world are doing everything in their power to bring those responsible to justice."
"I want to believe you, but you can understand if I have my reservations. Med was killed during an attack on your enemies. There are some who believe your father-in-law was behind the attack."
"That makes no sense," Sarah objected. "The king wants to improve our relationship with your revered order. That was why he agreed to let Med come to our world in the first place."
"There are some who believe the king used Med to help find his enemies. They claim that was his plan all along."
"Med's death was a tragic coincidence, not a part of some devious plot to exploit the Jedi," the princess insisted. "He was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
As for the king, he had no knowledge of the assassination whatsoever. I give you my word.
Unfortunately, your word will not be proof enough to allay the fears of those in my order.
Then let them use logic, Sarah argued. My father-in-law is not a fool. If he wanted to use the Jedi to seek revenge, he would have been smart enough to cover his tracks. He would have waited until after Med had left before ordering the attack.
Sometimes when we are blinded by grief, we aren't able to look past our immediate desires.
Is that what you really believe, Master Oba? Or are you just looking for someone to blame for the death of your former Padawan? The Ithorian sighed.
I admit my own judgment in this may be clouded by my personal feelings. That is why I must trust in the Force and allow it to guide my thoughts and actions.
There is no emotion, there is peace, the princess remarked.
You have studied our code?
Only informally.
I should have suspected as much. I can feel the Force is strong in you.
Lucia's eyes popped open in surprise, though Sarah took his observation completely in stride. I fear I'm too old to be recruited into your order, Master Oba, she said with a faint smile.
Even so, the words of our mantra can serve you well. You must be ever wary of the temptations of the dark side.
Like the talismans Med was sent to find? Sarah countered. That's what this is really about, isn't it? The Ithorian nodded gravely.
As much as I grieve over his death, I must put those feelings aside and focus on the purpose of his original mission.
Lucia was impressed. So far the encounter had gone almost exactly as Sarah had predicted. During their preparations for the meeting, the princess had told her the Jedi cared most about ideology and the battle of light and dark than about living people. She had planned to exploit that knowledge to turn the conversation away from discussions of who had hired the assassin, with a little help from Lucia. The Jedi love to feel superior. Sarah had explained during the shuttle ride. They consider it their duty to educate and inform the ignorant masses. If you ask one of them a question, they can't help but answer it. We can use this to our advantage during our meeting. Forgive my interruption, Master Oba, Lucia said, recognizing the opportunity he'd given her. But are these talismans really that important?
I believe they are.
But how can you be so sure?
I am a member of the Council of First Knowledge.
Launching into a lesson just as Sarah had said he would.
We are keepers of the wisdom of the Jedi. We maintain the Great Library. We oversee the teachings of the younglings. And we seek out the ancient histories and holocrons that will bring us greater knowledge of the light side of the Force. But we are more than just caretakers. We are also guardians. Not all knowledge is pure. Some is touched by evil. There are secrets that must remain hidden. Forbidden teachings that should remain forever buried. There is a dark side to the Force. Unchecked, it brings death and destruction.
Lucia nodded, as if absorbing every word, but inside, she felt nothing but scorn. The arrogance of the Jedi knew no bounds. As a soldier serving in Khan's Brotherhood of Darkness, she had developed a rather different view of the dark side. The Sith taught that emotion, fear, anger, and even hate should be embraced. She had learned to draw strength from the so-called evil of the dark side, and it had helped her survive through war and years of suffering. The Jedi would never understand this. They lived in isolation, meditating in great towers at the center of the galaxy. They had no idea what it was like for the outcasts, the disenfranchised, and the forgotten people forced to live on the fringes of society.
The Council of First Knowledge is sworn to keep this terrible power from being unleashed.
Master Oba continued, oblivious of her true feelings.
But the influence of the dark side is scattered throughout the galaxy. as are the tools it uses to spread. Ancient texts of Sith sorcery, amulets imbued with malevolent energy, tainted crystals that can corrupt the minds of the innocent. Sometimes these artifacts are discovered by accident, and they fall into the hands of unsuspecting victims. They become agents of the dark side, wreaking havoc across the galaxy. Unless we get to them in time, we are trained in the handling of dark side artifacts. Some can be destroyed, but others are too powerful and must be safeguarded.
How would something like that end up on a remote world like Doan? Lucia asked, still playing her part.
Humans have been living on your world for at least 10,000 years. When the mining operations began several centuries ago, ancient burial mounds, crypts, and gravesites were often dug up, as were the remains of primitive villages abandoned long ago. On rare occasions, entire cities had even been discovered, entombed millennia earlier in mudslides or ancient volcanic eruptions. Some of these early civilizations worshipped the Sith and followed the ways of the dark side. When the people disappeared, the artifacts of their faith were often left behind.
How did you first hear about these artifacts? The princess suddenly asked, seizing on an idea.
Nothing but a rumor. We heard word that a mining team had discovered a cache of items and was offering them for sale to off-world collectors. Based on the descriptions, we felt the items might have been Sith talismans, so I sent Med to investigate.
If you heard about these items, then it's possible others could have heard about them as well. Med's killer might not have been an assassin sent to avenge my husband's death. It could have been someone interested in finding the talismans.
I have considered that possibility, though I had hoped it was not so.
The Ithorian turned his back on them, clearly troubled. He began to pace slowly back and forth in front of his plants, as if to calm himself before speaking again. Once again, Lucia was amazed at how easily the princess had controlled and directed the encounter. Oba had commented on Sarah being strong in the Force. That might help to explain.